Chemistry was getting a bad name in terms of effect on the environment. DuPont made a lot of DDT. And was it Rachel Carson? Yeah, she wrote this.
Sounds great.
Yeah. And I said, you know, DuPont has always prided itself on having things that lasted a long time. They did indeed want things that would be have a good shelf life and would last a long time. And I said, you know, it might be that there's be merit in having an insecticide that will become innocuous through deterioration in a reasonable time. This is, well, that violates all our principles. We're not making things to go bad. You know, we don't want to be accused of having shoddy things that just to sell more of it. You know, the old argument about to make shoddy merchandise and people have to buy a replacement. We want things that'll persist. I said, yeah, persist and do damage. And like DDT. That didn't go over so well. Sales department didn't think that was a very smart idea. I mean, so I said, well, that's my thought. I think in the long run, you're going to find that people are going to ask for the kinds of things that will deteriorate. Then I made another suggestion that got their public relations people a little riled up. I suggested that instead of their slogan, better things for better living through chemistry, which it was. I sounded as if I was a traitor to chemistry. I says, why don't you make it better things for a better living through research? You do research. Research has a nice connotation. Chemistry's getting a bad word. Better things for a better living through research. That ought to be your slogan. Well, they sent that to their public relations office, I guess, advertising office. It was rejected. They said they've spent millions of dollars on better things for better living through chemistry. They're not going to change that now. But do you know that some years later they changed it, but not to for research. They just dropped the for chemistry. It's now better things for better living. I had suggested they put in the for research as change one word, chemistry to research. They dropped the two words, and that's their slogan now, better things for better living. I think I may have a letter in the file. I was going to dig it out. I dig up some things yesterday in which I had made that suggestion, and I got a response saying that our advertising department says it won't work. They did it. The final thing that I did was disappointed. Now it sounds as if I'm finding fault with DuPont. Please understand, I enjoyed my relationships pretty much, and I thought that since they had expertise in synthesizing things, that they should go in for organic conductors. As a physical chemist, I said, look, electrical conductivity is important. You're making fabrics and the fibers for fabrics and films for various purposes. Why not make things that'll have some physical properties useful for electronics? Well, the old guard there was scared. They're chemists, not physicists, see. They were a little scared of that. They said, well, that's interesting, but I even went so far as to say, hey, I'll bet you could make a polymer that'll be drawn out so it'll conduct in the direction of the fiber, but not transversely, so it'll be its own insulator. And they said, well, that's science fiction, see. And, they haven't got to that yet. But the point is, organic semiconductors and organic conductors are very much the vogue now. And here I hold the management of DuPont responsible for their failure to envision something. They knew that chemistry, synthetic chemistry, was so valuable that they were going to do what they were sure of and not take the chances on something that they get their pants beaten off of if they got into electronics. So they shied away from it. Now, in the last few years, they've gotten into it, see. Mm-hmm. Well, my relationships with DuPont, I finally terminated it. It was voluntary on my part when we moved out to California, and I found that the travel was just too much. DuPont worked you pretty hard. They weren't slave drivers, and the actual circumstances were good, but they expected you there at 8 in the morning, and you worked through the day. And if I flew there the day before, changed our time by 3 hours, and then at the end of a couple of days got to Philadelphia and flew back home, got home late. It was pretty rough on me, especially when I had administrative responsibilities here. So I reluctantly resigned as a consultant. And they were very nice because they paid me a final retainer, not a retainer, but a final sort of a termination thing. And indeed, on one occasion subsequent, I went and talked to them purely ad hoc basis, and they were very receptive, and they gave me a little honorarium for it. But my consulting with DuPont was, by and large, a good combination of things, and except for the fact that I think my wife got a little unhappy that I traveled too much. It was a rewarding experience.
Did you do any other consulting?
Well, subsequently.
But not while you were with DuPont, you didn't have that?
No, no. Well, I did one thing, but it wasn't the same kind. Well, I had been asked to be a consultant by another company, but I declined. I told them I was already consulting. They said, that's all right. I said, I'm not going to consult for two companies at the same time. You know, where there's actually, there's Union Carbide wanted me to consult on not unrelated matters, and that would have been just no dice. So, but where I did a little bit was to give some expert testimony in a court trial for 3M. There was no conflict with DuPont because it had absolutely nothing to do with their business. It had to do with interpretation of something that a laboratory had done, and they wanted an expert witness to. I was in at least two trials, I think, or was there a third? No, there were two, and a third was scheduled but subsequently canceled. The first one went over very well because the judge made a very nice remark about the persuasive arguments of Professor Wall or Dean Wall. I don't know what they called me at that time. I was already a dean, even, see. But the thing is, he, and 3M won that. But then they had another case, and I studied their case, and I says, I don't think you got a good case. They says, well, we got to go to court and try it. And he says, all right, won't you testify? I says, sure, I'll testify, but I don't think you got the case that you had the time before. And sure enough, they lost. Didn't make me feel good because, you know, yeah, they paid me for testifying, but in a way I said, I had some compunctions, but my compunctions stemmed from the fact that I didn't like to do it if I didn't think they were really going to win.
I understand.
And that bothered me. Then they had a third case in which I thought they were on the winning side, but it turned out that though the trial was scheduled, the case was dropped because they had a settlement out of court. So, and I don't know what the settlement was, and that was the extent of the expert testimony which I had given. This was while I was still at Illinois, that sort of that business. Now, at Illinois,
when you were at U.S. River, was Frank Mayo there then?
Yes, yes, he was.
Did you interact with him?
Yes, yes, I did.
Because later on, I noticed you had one little
it was a little thing where different people around the country were working on similar problems and using different notation, and the idea was to agree on some notation. I met Frank Mayo there and was very much impressed by him. He was a pretty sound individual. He subsequently went, I don't know by what route, or was directly to Stanford Research Institute. Mayo's very capable, capable fellow. In Illinois, perhaps I should return to Illinois and tell some about my experiences there. I got involved in a fair amount of committee work, the kind of thing that you get loaded with if you don't protest too much, you know, and I don't know, I worked on committees, and there was one committee that was called a committee on, something about the future of the university. That wasn't the name, but some planning for the future, and I got to know some other people on that committee. Indeed, I made an excellent friendship of a civil engineer, a fellow by the name of Nate Newmark, who was on the committee. And this turned out to be a very fine friendship because our families got involved. We maintained connections right along. But in addition, my committee work was evident and noted because then I was made a member of the University Research Board, which was adjunct of the graduate school. And the dean was chairman of the University Research Board, and I was a member of that. And I was on that board for a number of years, and it was a good experience because you got a feel for things going on in the university outside of your own field. We'd have requests from people in the humanities and the social sciences and so on, and this was all very nice and broadening, and I really did like the fact that there was something more than just chemistry. As much as my capacities in research were limited to chemistry, still I enjoyed listening to other things to find out what was going on. And the dean, whose name was Carmichael, ultimately retired. There was a new dean, Louis Reidenauer, a physicist, came. Well, Louis Reidenauer took leave one year to work in the Pentagon in connection with some research for the Korean War. And at that time, they appointed an acting dean, but Louis suggested that maybe they should have, well, I don't know the words he used, but anyhow, somebody other than that acting dean as chairman of the research board. And they put the finger on me. So I was chairman of the research board, and there was an acting dean for the normal routine of the graduate school. Well, it turned out that the finances were somewhat in the shambles. Louis had made commitments that exceeded the amount of funds available, and I had to make special representations to the top administration of the university to bail us out and get us back on the track. But it turned out that for me, as though it was an unhappy task to have to straighten things out, it was an opportunity, because that was noted. And the administration took pretty kindly to me for what I had done in straightening it out. So the ensuing year, I was asked to be acting dean. The other acting dean had quit after one year. And the president of the university said, since you still want your connection to chemistry, you probably don't want to have all the duties, so we'll relieve you of the chairmanship of the research board while you're acting dean. The deanship had the titular prescription, the chairman of the research board did not. I says, oh no. I says, look, that chairmanship of the research board is more interesting than being dean, I'm sure. If you want me to be acting dean, I'll do it, but I'll do what the dean used to be. I'll also be chairman of the research board, and if I have to make a choice, I'd take the one, not the other. He says, all right, if that's the way you want it, do it. So I became acting dean. And this was, then it put me out of the crossroads. The question was, could I continue any research while I had this? I was aware of the fact that people would say, geez, how I wish I could do research, but I've got all these responsibilities that keep me from doing it, you know, if only I had the opportunity. And I said, this is a temporary job. I cannot use this temporary job as an excuse because I'll get out of whack, and then what happens when I go back? So I have to keep on my research, which I did. I didn't do any teaching then. Instead of serving on committees, I appointed committees, and which is one way of getting out of them. And I worked hard, but I didn't forego my ongoing research. At that particular time, the University of Illinois was just getting started in some computer work. And thanks to Louis Reidenauer, who was interested in developing computers, they got a somewhat of a start on an ad hoc basis. And I worked hard then to get a permanent item in the budget so it'd be recognized. It wasn't a large item to start with, but it was a listed item, you know, different from just, you know, ad hoc. But and I was much interested in the computer and wanted to see it developed. Ultimately, they built what is known as the ILIAC, which was based on Johnny von Neumann's design at Princeton, but which was completed in Illinois before they completed the one at Princeton, actually. I don't know if you've ever heard about the ILIAC, but it was one of the first university computers, of high-speed digital computers. High speed for those days, low by any standards today.
What year was this?
It was after the war, long about 1950, thereabouts. One of my papers, and I'll get to that research, and I can tell you more precisely when it happened. Anyhow, after my year as acting dean, I was asked if I wouldn't be permanent dean. I says, no, I didn't want to be dean permanently. So they hunted for a permanent dean. But I let the president know. I says, look, but I am still interested in helping the university, you understand. If you don't mind, I would be delighted to continue as chairman of the research board. I didn't know at the time fully why it was that this was... I got out of it. I got a lot of fun out of learning about the different kinds of things that was going on, having a hand, getting to know people in other departments of the university, and so on. And if one diligently applied it, the people around the rest of the university likewise began to like you for it. I mean, so it was doubly rewarding. The latter part was, if you can give money, you can make friends. It's like a political thing. Though that thought never occurred to me, because the magnitude was not like, you know, politics in a big way. So I continued as chairman of the research board. And the new dean, who was the permanent dean, we had a good rapport. Everything worked out very well. Then he left and went to, his name, he was a botanist by the name of Oswald Tipple, and he went to Colorado, I believe. Was it Colorado? Yes, I think it was Colorado. Anyhow, he did ultimately go there. Maybe there was something in between. And then... again, they made a search for a dean, and they said, well, why don't you be dean? So this time I said, all right. I had already done enough. I had continued research under these various duties, so I felt that I could continue it, which I did. And I'm reminded of the old story of a fellow who he was a big husky fellow who could carry a cow in his arms, see? And how did he do it? Well, when it was a calf, he carried the calf, and every day he carried the calf, and the calf got bigger, but he never stopped, and that's why he can still carry the cow. Well, in a way, that was it. I was able to do research and the other, and some of my best research was done while I was dean, actually, as it turned out. And only because of this peculiar way of probing, trying, and making sure, and so on. And it was while I was dean, that I did the research that ultimately got me elected to the National Academy. So I'm virtually certain of that, but you don't know for sure. There was an element of politicking that I can tell you a little about, politicking on the part of my friends. But at any rate, I was then now... the permanent dean and chairman of the research board, and we got a new president at the same time. Well, my research was going great guns, and part of the reason was that I got involved in computer calculations. I was interested in the computer, I was interested in statistics, and in the ILIAC had been completed, and shortly after its completion, I said, there's a job that I want to do. I was interested in configurations of macromolecules, rubber-like molecules. So we started a Monte Carlo method for simulating coiling-type molecules. And there's a paper by me and Hiller and... Wheeler. That's the one, yeah. Okay. That, by the way, is the first paper on Monte Carlo calculations of macromoleculars used on a high-speed digital computer. That's why I put a double star there, yes. Because that, I thought, was a breaking point for me. It was just prior to that the computer laboratory had been formally established, I got them a budget as dean, and kept pushing. And of course, they were very nice to me. They says, "Well, if the dean's going to help us that way, let's help him and let me use the computer."
Wasn't Wheeler in the computing laboratory?
But he was from England. He was from Oxford. You see, Illinois had already gotten a reputation for a university where they were going in for computers. See, there weren't too many around. This was early on, and so this fellow from Oxford came to the University of Illinois, and he was there for a year. And Wheeler and I and Hiller.
Was he one of your graduate students?
Hiller, no. Oh, there's an interesting story about Hiller. I'll tell you about him, too.
Okay.
Wheeler, Hiller, and I got together on it, and I set forth the problem. Hiller and Wheeler prepared the programming for the machine, and the programming was a time-consuming business because in those days, unlike a thing like this, you had to write in machine language. It was a chore, and really a chore.
Yes.
So they worked up the program, and then we generated this Monte Carlo method, as we called it, for simulating polymers, and it was a breakthrough.
Is this the one where you use the vectors to?
You take a step, let's say. Actually, we had a tetrahedral lattice, but you'd take a step, and then you'd have three choices, see? And you'd pick a random number to decide where you go. Then you made sure that where you went wasn't already occupied. Okay. Then you'd make a random choice, make sure that where you went wasn't already occupied. If you was already occupied, that'd be disallowed as a configuration, and you'd start over again. But we could, there's a certain rate of attrition. And we improved the attrition. We kept down. There's a whole series of papers where we had more efficient ways of doing it and that kind of thing. To avoid inadvertent bias is one of the hardest things in this whole business of Monte Carlo studies. But at any rate, I believe, it is true that that was the first paper published by anybody on Monte Carlo methods for macromolecular configurations. And we did a fair amount of additional work on that, but then we did something else, also with Hiller and Mazur, and that was the calculation of the dynamics of chemical reactions. I forgot what the title is. I put a star there, too, or double star. Yeah. Statistical computational reaction probabilities. Yeah. That was, again, a first in the sense that it was the first calculation of any serious magnitude on calculating collision probabilities. We took a simple case. A hydrogen molecule is hit by a hydrogen atom. What's the chance that this incoming atom will kick the other one off? The simplest possible chemical reaction you could think of. You start at rudimentary things. This was rudimentary. There's no question about it. People would say, how naive could you be? No, who ever thinks about a thing like that? That was a chore to do that and program it and do it on a computer. That was the first one. Then we did some more on it, and happily, John Polanyi, who got Nobel Prize, he's from Toronto, you know, said in his Nobel Prize address that there was a lot of things done with computers, but the full, I forgot his words, full impact of potential for the method did not come up until Wall and his colleagues did that. I think you'll find that in Polanyi's paper. And the reason I cite that is because I hate to be self-serving. I'd rather quote somebody else as saying it, but I believe it is correct.
Quite a recognition then.
Well, yeah. But by the same token, now I have to tell you something else. I was never one to follow through enough to be identified as what you could call the old man of that field. You know, I would do something when I was satisfied it could be done. I'd say, isn't there something else I can do? Just as I went from the macromolecular configurations to the reaction probability. The reaction probability thing, then that's burgeoned. I mean, hell, people are calculating this stuff all over town now. I mean, all around the country and around the world. It's going on all the time. And with a lot faster computers than we had on this Iliac. But now, my stay in Illinois was overall a pretty happy one, except for one thing. I'm telling you the truth about things now. I didn't get along well with the university president. The president, this was a new president, had not been involved in my appointments in the first instance, was very much concerned with public relations. So much so that he appeared to regard public relations as an end in itself. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but in other words, if you could persuade people that you were good, that was all you had to do. You didn't have to actually be good. It isn't a question of... I said public relations may be a means to some end, but somehow or other, we ought not just brag about what we're doing. Why don't we do something? Let's get on with it. And I said to the president, my goal would be to make the University of Illinois the best university between Harvard and Berkeley. And we can achieve that, I said, in our lifetimes. And that, I said to him, that was what I wanted to achieve. And, but he was sensitive, so sensitive to political things and so on. And this gets me back to Linus Pauling. There is a fund established at Illinois, a so-called George A. Miller Fund, from the estate of a former professor there, who this money was used for lectureships and various and sundry purposes. And the chemistry department wanted to invite Linus Pauling to give some lectures. So I was asked to extend the invitation on behalf of the university. And so I wrote to Linus and said, wonder if you would come and give some lectures. And he thought the thing over and wrote back and says, yes, he would like to do that. And this was done during, say, the correspondence took place in the spring of the year for some time the ensuing academic year. And we agreed and set up a schedule. And that was very nice.